Good morning or afternoon to you. This lecture is entitled Communication and Management Theory, Understanding the Connections. My job today is to talk a little bit about the way in which the fields of communication and the fields of business or management kind of come together in certain areas by looking at the way in which we try to understand managers' behavior and try and theorize about what makes managers tick and how it is that managers should view their employees. There are a lot of connections in this area, and I understand that you folks in the business school have an entire semester's worth of class that looks solely at management theory. And the truth is that I'm going to try and do this in about an hour and 15 minutes, and so make sure that you've got a pen, and make sure you're looking at the PowerPoint slides, because we're going to be zipping through some of this stuff. But in the end, what I hope to give you is a way of looking at management theory through the lens of communications. I think it may give you a way of understanding how these theories have evolved, how they connect together, why we group certain ones with others. I think that the chapter actually in the Adler book is quite good, but I'm going to give you some additional details here and there and try and flesh out some of the examples that they've talked about. I think a fair place to start was a question about why we would study management theories or management paradigms at all. And I think there are a number of pretty reasonable answers here. The first is that management theories form the basis of how managers manage. So if you expect to be a manager at some point in your career, if you expect to be the one giving orders, if you expect to be the one trying to figure out how to motivate folks, it's really important that you understand that there are different approaches. There is no one best way to managing. And the result is that you may be looking at, again, another theme here, a repertoire of different management theories that would help you to understand how to go about your job. Even if you never become a manager, even if you don't have any aspirations for being a high-up mucky-muck in an organization, it still, I think, gives us some pause to the more you know about management theories, the more you know about what makes your manager tick. So I think workers, people who are, subordinates in organizations, that this can be very valuable information as well. Another answer about in looking at why we would study management theories is that ultimately management theories are theories of human behavior. They tell us why people do the things they do, why they act the way they act, why they make the choices that they've made. And so for that alone, I think it's an interesting field of study because human behavior, of course, is one of the more complex and undecipherable kinds of areas of study. And it's really the place that psychology looks to go and sociology looks to go. It's certainly in the field of communication studies, we're looking at people's communication behavior. Management and the field of business is always looking at how consumers behave the way they do. And so looking at management theories as theories of human behavior, yes, I'm afraid you're going to have to admit that your manager is human in order to embrace this answer, but that alone makes it a good reason to try and study management theory. Another reason this is very important from the field of communication studies and the viewpoint that they have is that when you look at any management theory, whether it's 100 years old or whether it's just out for 15 minutes and it's the newest big thing on in the MBA programs or in the business section of Borders books, any management theory is only made real. It is only enacted by and through communication. It has to be mediated in some way by the language that you choose, by the demeanor that you choose for talking with your employees, the mode of communication that you choose in order to kind of send a message to the employees. There is simply no way to enact a management theory to say, this is how I'm going to govern or this is how I'm going to manage, except through communication. And for that reason alone, it, I think, opens a door for a collaboration between the folks in the business school and the folks in my field, communication study. And one of the reasons, frankly, why they have this course is so that you can see the connections between those two. I think a final reason for thinking about why we would study management theories have to do with the fact that, frankly, some of our managers, some of the folks that you've probably worked for, can be difficult to get along with, undecipherable. They seem to be doing one thing one minute and another thing another minute. One of the reasons you would want to study management theory is because by studying management theories, I think we have a better chance of figuring out why those managers are acting the way they are. They may seem to have no rhyme or reason. They may appear to have no consistency in the way they manage. But it could be that what's actually happening is they're struggling between two different management paradigms and trying to figure out how they want to relate to their employees. Again, studying the different paradigms, understanding which ones are kind of have something in common with others is going to give, whether you're just the employee or a fellow manager or a supervisor, a leg up on understanding the situation. I'm going to begin the body of the lecture by talking about some classical management theories. They're classical in the sense that they came first. They're classical in the sense that they are kind of foundational kinds of approaches to the study of management. And in many ways, they are the history of the discipline. The three that I'm going to talk about are scientific management, and the person most closely associated with that is Frederick Taylor. In fact, he's so closely associated with scientific management that his work is sometimes referred to, or scientific management is sometimes referred to, as Taylorism. So we're going to talk first about Frederick Taylor. We're going to talk next about Henri Fayol. Fayol was a French mining supervisor. He ran some of the very largest French mining concerns and French colonies at the beginning of the 20th century. And in fact, once he wrote a book on management theory, and once it was translated into English and began to be taught in various schools around the country and indeed around the world, his stuff is so foundational that there are things that we have now in management theory that are so basic and so fundamental that actually came out of Fayol's work that it's kind of interesting that we don't even acknowledge Fayol anymore. So when I get to some of those concepts, I think you certainly will have heard of them before. And what's interesting is they are so foundational that we don't even think of them as necessarily being Fayol's. They're just part of the entire lore or discipline of management theory. The final one I'm going to talk about is a German sociologist. His name is Max Weber. I know it's spelled W-E-B-E-R, but those Germans generally pronounce their W's in this position as V's. So we've got Max Weber. As a sociologist, he was very prolific. His stuff has been was translated into English in the, mid-20s and 30s, the 1920s, 1930s. And it was and has been very influential. His theory is called bureaucratic theory, and I'll talk about that. So those are the three, and so let's move on. The first one I told you I was going to talk about is Taylorism, or what came to be called scientific management. And really, Taylor is one of these folks who was a real practitioner. He was a real manager of steel mines in the late 19th century, and had some different ideas about how it was he was going to manage his steel mills. And he became so wildly successful and so popular as people began to pay attention to his work that he began to write books. Those books immediately became influential to the point where some historians have written that Frederick Taylor may be one of the most influential people from the 20th century that you've probably never heard of, particularly at the beginning of the century. Scientific management really revolutionized the Industrial Revolution, and Taylor's principles and Taylor's approach to scientific management was wildly popular with both American industry and overseas, to the point where you can still see some remnants of Frederick Taylor's scientific management in some different companies around the world, and even right here close in Sacramento, from my dealings with and talking to some of the employees of the United Parcel service. My sense is that there is still some very significant portions of Taylor's scientific management in operation at the UPS Center over in West Sacramento. So we're going to talk a little about it. If you had to pick a one phrase that describes Taylor's approach to management, it was that there was one best way to perform an industrial task. So whether you were scooping coal or building widgets, whatever you were doing, he thought that it would be best optimized, that you would find the most efficient way to do it by using science, by doing close observations and kind of varying things and looking for output, and that science was the domain of management. They would figure out the one best way to get a particular job done, and then they would appropriately choose and train workers to do it that one best way. There was no room for creativity. There was no room for, years of experience that somebody had been, building shoes. Management comes in, determines this is the way we want it done, and the only real reaction from the workers was, okay, let's get it done. They used what were called time motion studies, where they would look at the way in which these, anything in industry was being built. I'll use widgets as the kind of classical, mythical business object, and say that if your company was building widgets, they would do studies to figure out the most efficient way to build a widget, and then they would, among other things, not only change the work process, but they would change the way they paid their workers. Instead of paying you a flat rate per hour, most of the jobs in Taylor-driven factories were done on what was called piece rate. And so if your job was making widgets, you were paid not, a dollar an hour, you were paid 10 cents a widget. And so if you could make 10 widgets an hour, you were making a dollar an hour. But because of the studies that Taylor and his other managers in a plant would do, he would find that his workers could soon become very, very efficient. So instead of making, say, 10 widgets an hour, they're making 15 or even 18 widgets an hour. And that resulted in some very big changes in the American industrial workplace. It meant that you could use fewer workers to get the same level of productivity, which was great for, of course, the factory owners because they had fewer people that they had to pay and manage. It was good for the individual workers, it seemed, because they would be able to earn more money. And Taylor's view was that, a worker who had six kids was going to work harder than somebody who only had one. They would want to earn more money, so they would be the ones to push production and be making 15 or 18 widgets an hour. It was important under this kind of scenario that you choose your workers kind of scientifically. If the job was shoveling coal, Taylor would tell the managers that it's more important to hire, some big guy, 6'3", 230 pounds, and more appropriate than, hiring somebody who is 5'10", and, 160. It was more important to choose the worker best suited for that job and then control every aspect of that job to the point of even if the job was shoveling coal. I mean, think about it. Here's a great example of where Taylor could make a difference. He would come in and look at the job of shoveling coal into a burner for making steel. And he would look at the shovel itself. And if you think about it, the blade of a shovel can be, various sizes. You can have shovels that are real teeny, 4 by 5 inches, the kind that you used to use made of plastic at the beach, right? And they were great for shoveling beach sand. But if you gave a worker shoveling coal a little shovel like that, oh yeah, they could pick up one or two pieces of coal probably, and they could work at a pretty fast clip, but because the shovel was so small, no matter how quickly they worked, they weren't being very efficient. Of course, the other side of that is you could give workers this huge shovel with, say, a 4 by 5 foot blade where they could go in and they could pick up, 150 pounds of coal at the same time and kind of stagger over to the opening of the burner and throw it in. But then they'd have to take a break because they've just moved a huge amount of coal. So somewhere in the middle there, Frederick Taylor would say, there is not only one best way to perform a task, there's one best tool to help you perform that task, and they would scientifically determine that a particular sized shovel was best for that particular job. And so, though for the workers, it seemed like every aspect of their life was controlled, many workers believed in scientific management or responded well to scientific management because in the firms and in the job sites where it was actually implemented, it often meant that for the workers who were able to stay on, they would be actually making a lot more money because instead of making a dollar per hour, they're on the piece rate, they have the ability to control things and control their own destiny and paycheck, and the result was there were very many positive things. The important mantra about all this, was a strict division of labor. There was management and there were the workers. If you think back even 30 or 40 years before, if you had a little shop where people were making shoes, the distinction between the owner who was making shoes and the workers, the apprentices who were making shoes in the same shop, really wasn't that big. Everybody was doing the same task. Really what happened as a result of scientific management, there became a class of workers called managers whose job was to figure out how to do the task and make sure that the workers were doing that task. Anybody in that shop, on a scientific management shop, had to take orders from any of the managers because supposedly all the managers were working from the same page. They knew how the job was supposed to be accomplished. They had science behind them, and that's the way it was. And if you couldn't get along or if you couldn't do the job the way they wanted it done, they'd get somebody else. It was pretty much as simple as that. Unfortunately for Taylor, by the mid-1920s, some of the benefits of scientific management began to be overshadowed by some of the distinct disadvantages. And let me kind of spin out a scenario again using a factory that makes widgets. So let's say you're selling widgets and, you know, typically you've been paying people a dollar an hour and their output has, let's say, been 7 to 8 widgets an hour and you would then sell those widgets. Well, once Taylor comes in or an advocate of Taylor's perspective on scientific management comes in and retools your workplace and all of a sudden people are being paid piece rate and all of a sudden you've got people making widgets at like 15 an hour instead of 7 or 8, you've doubled the output of that plant. Now, one thing you may want to do is you start cutting back on the less productive workers, the ones who really can't do as much for you as the ones who are doing very well and making widgets, you know, really, really fast. But eventually what happens is in those situations, your market for widgets, remember all the other widget makers are beginning to go to Taylor as well. And all of a sudden what we're finding is we have a market that's glutted with widgets, right? There's nothing particularly remarkable about the Burnett Widget Factory. It's just, you know, we've turned out widgets, but so have the other three factories down the street. Well, you know, even a student who gets a D in introductory economics can probably tell you what happens when the market gets flooded with too much of a product. Anybody? Did you get a D in economics? The price falls, right? You've got oversupply, then prices begin to plunge. When prices begin to plunge, then the managers take a look at their work site and they begin to do something for which the unions, which were just beginning to really build up at this time in the early part of the 20th century, the unions just went nuts because what would happen is the managers would come back and they would cut the piece rate. So instead of making 10 cents a widget, they would come back to the workplace and say, you know what, we're not selling as many widgets or there's a lot of widgets out in the marketplace, so we've got to cut our costs in order to remain competitive. And instead of making 10 cents a widget, now workers are only going to make 8 cents a widget. So if you make 10 widgets, you're only making 80 cents an hour. And in order to make $1.60 an hour, you've got to make 20 widgets an hour. So you've had to significantly pick up the pace because they've actually cut your wages from 10 cents a widget to 8 cents a widget. That's a 20% cut in your wages, essentially. And so you began in many cases to see a downward spiral in the rate of pay for people. And as a result, there were some significant questions about whether or not Taylorism was even the best way to deal with these things. By the late 19-teens and into the early 1920s, problems in American industry became so severe that the U.S. Congress actually stepped in and held hearings on Taylorism to see whether or not it was in fact some plot that had been instituted by the Bolsheviks. There were all kinds of crazy charges flying around for Taylor. He was actually called in to testify, and frankly, it was so demoralizing to him, it so destroyed what he had worked so hard to put together that he actually died a few years later. But Taylorism has lived on, and any place that actually has a piece rate, like picking fruit, is a shop that ultimately is influenced by Taylor. There are still many factories overseas that are run by scientific management. It was a hugely influential management theory, but it was not the only one that would be regarded as part of classical theory. I want to move on to Henri Fayol. He is actually working at about the same time, turn of the century, a little later, as Frederick Taylor. But he ran a French mining conglomerate. They had divisions all over the world because at this time the French still had a lot of colonial property in Africa, and mining was a big part of that. Ultimately, and one of the things that really influenced Henri Fayol was that he was a military man by training. And so a lot of the things that he brought to his general management theory were influenced by the military. So let's look at some of the key concepts. Really, if you go back and read Henri Fayol's work, you'll see that there are 16 key concepts. I'm not going to talk about all 16, but I'm going to talk about some of the ones that are really important. Fayol, like Henry Ford before him, understood that division of labor was a really important thing. You want to get the task that needs to be done broken down into its individual parts and then make sure that you train people so that they can efficiently do those individual jobs. So nobody is making an entire shoe anymore. There are people who are fitting the leathers. There are people who are making the soles. There are people who are putting in the third eyelet on the left shoe, and that's all they did all day. And so this is what some of the Marxists begin to talk about people being alienated from their work, because no longer could a worker take pride and say, I am a shoemaker, any more than somebody who flips burgers at a McDonald's can say that they're a chef. If you've ever worked in fast food, you know that one of the things that they've done in the fast food industry is they've de-skilled the people who work there. It's all become complete idiot work with no individual creativity. They tell you how long to cook the fries. They tell you exactly what to do with the fries when you're done. All of it is done so that it is really takes very little intellectual capacity. I'm sorry, I worked in fast food too, so I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. But the point is, it's de-skilled people. Division of labor is a central issue in that, because if all you do all day is cut onions to supply the trays in the togos where you work, that's not much of a skill. Division of labor, but it's, instead of one person from beginning to end going out and, cutting the onions and cutting the tomatoes and shredding the lettuce and cutting the, cold cuts in order to make a sandwich, all that gets done by people who are efficiently doing that work. And that's what division of work is all about, and it was a key concept in Fayol's management theory. The next element of Fayol's management theory that's important was called unity of command. Fayol really much, and again, you can see the military influence here, believed that you should take orders from your immediate supervisor. That was a little different from Taylor, frankly, because in Taylor's scheme, remember, the managers are supposedly all working from the same plan, so any subordinate really had to take orders from almost any manager. But as in the military, where the key person in your life is your immediate supervisor, right? The private reports to the corporal reports to the sergeant, and so on. That unity of command is very, very important. A third element of Henri Fayol's general management theory, again, you can borrow, I think, from the military, but it's very important in today's modern corporations to the point where many, many people don't even think about it. It's called subordination of individual interest. The best thing that any corporation can do to get you to be a compliant and effective worker is to make sure that you believe that your interests are best served by identifying with the unit as a whole as opposed to your individual units. So, for instance, Sac State makes me a more effective manager when I begin to believe that I have to work for the best interests of Sac State and not for the best interests of Nick Burnett. The reason is that if I can get my workers identifying with the whole and they're all working in that in furtherance of that goal, they are much easier to manage. I have to throw fewer resources at managing those people because, frankly, they're all doing what they want to be doing and they understand that they are best served by identifying with the whole. As you can see, this absolutely strikes at the heart of what the Marxists were trying to tell people, that there were significant differences in the interests between the workers and the owners of the means of production. Marxists see that as an absolutely confrontational, antagonistic relationship. And what Fayol is trying to get people to do is to say, you know what, your best interest in working as a fry chef at Burger King or McDonald's are best served by becoming part of a team. And so what do those workplaces do? They give everybody uniforms. Everybody gets the same training. There are little awards for people who do their jobs very well. And all of a sudden, they've gotten you to think like a company person instead of somebody sticking up for their own best interests. I mean, there can't be a lot of individual interest in, you know, being covered with cooking oil all day and burning your fingers on hot French fries. And yet, that's really kind of part of what any modern corporation does. They try to get their folks to subordinate their individual interests to the interests of the corporation. And that's a key part of management theory. And that ultimately comes back from Henri Fayol. Two final things I want to talk about here with Fayol. Esprit de corps, that's a French term that I've left in the original French because there's really not a great English translation. Esprit de corps is kind of like morale on steroids. It's that gung-ho kind of approach to life. It's the Walmart morning morale meeting that you see. It's the fact that, again, people are happy to be at work, people are feeling good about each other, and that ultimately it makes them want to work harder for the corporation. Maintaining that positive esprit de corps, again, is something that Fayol brought from his military work, and it brought it into the corporation as well. Final thing here is centralization is a one of the key concepts for Henri Fayol's management theory. Centralization means that the power gets concentrated at the top, and the organizations that come from this kind of background, the organizations that evolve, that are using management theory, really tend to be very, very hierarchical because decisions are made at only the highest level. At this point, things like chain of command become very important. It means that the span of control, which is another of Fayol's kind of concepts, is fairly small because you can only have, say, five or six persons before you got to have somebody to supervise those workers. You can only have five or six supervisors before a general manager needs to come in to supervise the supervisors, and on and on and on, and you tend to get very tall, kind of thin organizations decisions instead of ones where decision-making is decentralized and spread throughout the organization. So Henri Fayol, very interesting character, French mining engineer who brings a lot of his military background into his thinking about general management theory. Some of his stuff is so foundational and so key to what we think of now as management theory just generically that he really hasn't gotten his place in management theory and classical management. Max Weber is the last classical management theory person I want to talk about. And interestingly, to understand, I think, what Max Weber was writing about, and let me tell you, I'm actually doing you a pretty big favor here. If you read the original work of Max Weber in German, or even worse, if you read the original translations into English of Max Weber, oh, my Lord, I can't believe that anybody can be quite that boring. Let's just say Max Weber's prose is as good as any sleeping medicine that I've ever come across. But he is a hugely influential figure both in sociology and industrial sociology and in business. Because what interested Max Weber the most was what we have now come to call bureaucracy. He was a bureaucratic theorist, and in fact, his theories are called bureaucratic theory. Now, you have to remember what Weber is reacting to. He's looking at the German government in the late 1800s and early 1900s, a system that was so corrupt, so inefficient, so completely unworkable and not meeting the needs of the citizenry that it was almost going to cause the collapse of the German state. I mean, it was completely a mess because people hired their buddies, people hired their families. The way to get a job was who you knew, not what you knew. Who you knew was more important, not what you knew. The result is it was a complete mess. And so Weber tried to imagine a better world, a world that ultimately he thought would bring more efficient services from the state to the citizens. And so bureaucracy was a positive word for him because it had some rules. And so let's talk about what those rules are. The first is that there should be a clear system of authority. People should know who their supervisors are and who they should take direction from. Think about comparing a modern, say, civil service organization to a family-run business. If you're supervising a member of the family that owns a company, and you're not a part of that family, like you're just one of the other workers that they've brought in, and you've got, you know, the nephew of the CEO of this little family-run company is working for you, do you really think that that person is going to pay attention to you or to Uncle Wally, who owns the company? Weber looked at that and was simply horrified and said, instead, people should know who their supervisors are. There should be authority that is placed in the position, that is, the role that you fill in the organization, and not by virtue of who you are. So it shouldn't be who you know. It shouldn't be the fact that you're connected or that you're a part of the family or whatever else. It should be that because you are the general manager, you have the authority to impose your will on other people below you in the organizational chart. Another thing that was very important for Weber was to have complete written rules and regulations. This kind of a system allows for people to understand completely what's required of a particular job. It allows you to go out and recruit people who can actually, you know, demonstrate that they have the skills that are necessary to do those jobs. It means an orderly functioning of an organization should one member, you know, be hit by a bus. You know that there are some little organizations out there that if the owner got hit by a bus one afternoon, the small business would fail because they simply didn't have this stuff written down. Really, if you look at I'm back to a kind of civil service kind of organization. Let's say the state here in California clearly works under civil service rules. everything is written down. How you do your job, the job description itself, what rights and responsibilities you have as an employee within that system, how to bring a grievance, how to request a transfer. Everything is written down. And that is very much a kind of legacy of what Max Weber was trying to write about. Next on the, you see on the chart there, another kind of important element of Weber's work on bureaucracy was his belief that organizational relationships needed to stay impersonal. You needed not, it was important to have supervisors not dating their subordinates, and you can see the legacies of this all over the place, that there not be any kind of relationships outside of the organizational chart of an organization. You know, subordinates shouldn't be dating their supervisors. Actually, this is a legacy of as well from the military, right? In the military, they have, for folks who are, for it's off hours, and you want to go get a beer. Well, if you're a private or if you're a corporal, you don't get to go to the officers' club because that's where the officers sit and have drinks and play poker and whatever else they do. And it was important that they did not want the officers fraternizing with non-commissioned officers and folks lower in the totem pole, because those officers may very well have to place those people in danger later on when they're out in the field. And they didn't want military decisions being made based on who is your buddy and who do you play poker with on Saturday night or who are you dating. And so it was very important that officers be a little less connected to, more aloof, more reserved, and away from the enlisted personnel. And ultimately, that kind of thought is what comes through Weber as well, and that these organizational relationships stay impersonal. That's why there are things like strict nepotism rules in large organizations. Again, those are based simply on Weber's bureaucratic theory. Weber also believed that when you promote people or when you select people for a position, that ultimately they should be based on technical competence. We know what the job involves because we have a clearly full written out job description, and we need to make sure that the people that you hire for that position have the technical competence to do it. The German government at the turn of the 19th, the end of the 19th century was so riddled with what were called placeholders, nepotism. These were folks who got their job because of who they knew, not because they could do the job. Weber's reaction to that was really go in the opposite direction and say it should be a selection or promotion system based solely on whether or not you can do the job. What that all comes down to for Max Weber is his idea of heaven. Max Weber's idea of paradise would be what we now look at and maybe kind of say nasty things about, but bureaucracy was a positive connotation to him. A bureaucratic organization meant an organization that was run by the rules, meant that it wasn't going to be corrupted by people's personal relationships, and that ultimately, something like our contemporary civil service system, Max Weber would have been in heaven with. He would have thought that was terrific. Now, we think of bureaucracy perhaps in a slightly different way. We think it's, rigid and inflexible and slow moving. But frankly, for Weber, he saw those things as positive because they were so different from what he was reacting to in the German government back at the late 1800s. So ultimately, Weber's work, he does a lot of his writing in the early 1920s and 30s. That gets translated into English within a decade or so and begins to filter into the United States. Weber's work is still very influential, but frankly, be glad I didn't ask you to read a lot of Max Weber because you'd be snoring now. Okay, so that kind of sums up our classical theories. What is it then that causes those theories to kind of hold together as a group? And the next slide, I think, that you should be looking at on your PowerPoints can tell you, I think, that exactly. These theories or these management systems are all driven by managerial authority. The power is controlled at the top of the organization, and ultimately those people make the rules for everybody else. these kinds of theories all believe that people are rational economic actors, right? Weber and well, actually, most tellingly, Taylor believe that, you know, if I set up a system where you can make more money by working harder, that you'll work harder. You're rational, you're economic. If you have more kids, more mouths to feed, you'll work harder to make the money to do that. Such a system also, though, devalues the individual workers. And I think the best metaphor here is kind of a machine worker, where the workers are simply cogs in the machine. If a cog, you know, isn't cooperating, if somebody's not doing their job, if they're not up to the task, you know, these folks would simply say, well, replace them and get somebody who can. There's no, you know, sympathy. There's no relationship there. You know, when a tooth on a gear breaks in your car, you don't get all emotional about it and say, oh, it was such a good tooth. What a great little flywheel that was. No, you go out and you fix it, you get a new cog, you get a new part, and the machine goes on. And that was pretty much the attitude towards workers in classical management theory. Most important, though, for communication was that the communication that existed in these organizations that were run by classical management theories were very much top-down. So the communication only flowed in one direction. It flowed from the top of the organization or from the supervisors down to the workers. It was very much a situation where the authority of somebody being able to tell you what to do was tied to their position, and there was no expectation that there would be any flow of communication from the workers back up to the bosses. So it was very much a downward communication situation in these classical management theories. By the mid-1920s, people were really getting very excited about figuring out ways to tweak Taylorism and to make it work better. And so really out of that movement to kind of refine Taylor a little bit, our next set of management theories kind of comes out. I want to talk about something that was called the Human Relations Movement, and it was ultimately led, the people who are most notably connected to this were called Roethlisberger and Mayo. They were both professors at Harvard University. And they were hired on by the Western Electric Company to come out to their telephone relay assembly plant, which was this huge industrial plant where people stood on a line all day and made relays. I mean, we're really talking about widgets here, but relays were important. These are electrical relays that were found in telephones and other kind of mechanical devices. And so they had to make thousands and thousands of these each day, and they had thousands of workers in these plants making relays. And they figured if they could get somebody in there to help them be more efficient in the production of relays, that they would make more money and make more relays. So that they hired Roethlisberger and Mayo to come in as consultants. The Western Electric Company and the Hawthorne plants were just outside of Chicago in a little town called Cicero. Cicero, Illinois, was pretty much known for corruption and gangsters at that time. But nonetheless, Western Electric Company brought in Roethlisberger and Mayo, and they began to do some studies. One of the first studies they did, believing again that they were working on extending Taylorism, is they said, you know what, it's expensive to light these big industrial plants, and so what we're going to do is we're going to do a set of what are called illumination studies, where we figure out how bright does it have to be to optimize the output of the workers, right? If it's too bright, the workers are squinting their eyes, we're paying extra money for extra light bulbs. If it's too low, people can't see what they're doing, and you know, there might be safety issues. So they began to work with a small group of workers and varied the lighting in the experimental area to see what was the optimal level. Because according to Taylor, there ought to be one best level. There ought to be one place where you set the lights at that optimizes efficiency. It optimizes the cost issues related to lighting, lighting up these factories. And so they go. They begin to do these studies, and they're completely baffled by the findings. Because with this little group of workers that they brought together, they begin to drop the lights and check the output. And they would drop the lights, and the output, you know, went up a little. And they, you know, they extinguished more lights and made it a little darker, and output went up even more. And they got all the way down to the point where, honest to God, the workers were almost working in moonlight, and they're still pretty efficient. They're still churning out the relays at a pretty good clip. And they were completely baffled by this, because this would not have been what they would have predicted with trying to implement Taylorism. So they said, well, look, we're really confused now. We've got to do a different kind of study where we isolate a whole group of workers and look at the entire entire work environment to see what's the key to creating efficiency in the workplace. They put together something called the Relay Assembly Room Studies, and these are really what are at the heart of what are called the Hawthorne Studies. And you'll see Hawthorne referred to in almost every business textbook that you've probably ever bought. There's a lot of false information floating around about the Hawthorne studies, but I hope to kind of clear this up for you. In the relay assembly room studies that were done with a group of, maybe 25 or 30 workers, they isolated these workers from the other folks, the other thousands of workers in the workplace, and began to vary everything about their day, the speed at which they wanted them to work, whether or not they got breaks, whether or not they got their lunch paid for by the company. And as Roethlisberger and Mayo kind of worked their way through these different variables, trying to find out what was optimum, what they did find out is that it wasn't so much the environmental factors of their workplace that was driving production by these workers. It became really clear that these workers were striving to please Roethlisberger and Mayo. They felt special having been chosen by these Harvard researchers for this very important study. Out of all the thousands of workers, they were the 25 who had been chosen to do this important study. And so what they essentially did is to try and increase their output as much as they could. And it took a while for Roethlisberger and Mayo to figure out that that's exactly what was happening. And that's why the illumination studies came out the way they did. And that's why the relay assembly studies came out the way they did. And as they began to talk to the workers, it was like, a duh moment. They, head to the forehead, hand to the forehead and said, oh, my God, look, it's what's happening here. As we've been trying to do an experiment based on varying the elements of a worker's workplace, a worker's environment, there's something else that's creeping in altogether that's resulting in changes to the output. It's not the environment, it's the fact that they want to please the researchers. And so what they told management was that as a result of these relay assembly room studies, that really what they needed to do was to talk to individual workers, and they needed to find out what was important to the workers and what made them feel better about doing a good day's work for their workplace and doing their best every day. And so they began the interview part of their study, of the Hawthorne studies, where they literally tried to interview every worker who worked at the Hawthorne plant, and we're talking about thousands of workers, and asked them questions like, what is important to you about feeling good about coming to work or about feeling good about working hard once you get here? And they talked about workers needing to feel kind of more connected to their community and having more productive ways to spend their leisure time. And as a result of all of these interviews, there became a real significant change and a backlash away from Taylorism, because the sense was that Taylor really in the long run was wrong. That Taylorism suggested that people were always, rational economic actors, and yet what we're finding as a result of these interviews is that there's a lot of other things that go into how a worker feels, how committed they feel to a company, whether or not they're willing to work hard to increase production, rather than just the nuts and bolts and the dollar signs and things that go along with that. As a result, the company began to pay more attention to the workers and cater to their needs a little more. This was the dominant employer in that community. And they began to do things like set up bowling leagues and softball leagues. They began to at least make the workers think that they were paying more attention to their needs. And the result was that there were increases in productivity. no more were workers simply cogs in a machine. At this point, the machine metaphor didn't seem to make sense at all, and the results of the findings were rather profound. If you go to the next slide, you'll see some of the findings or implications of the Hawthorne studies. The first thing was that this was a huge wake-up call for social scientists. Social scientists had thought that they could simply go into industrial settings, do experiments where they varied different elements of the worker's environment or workday, and measure the results and then get some idea of what caused what. But the truth is, large-scale social scientific research was really thrown a real kind of deal breaker in this Hawthorne study, because if the workers changed not because their environment changed, but because they wanted to please the worker, or really it was the fact that they were being studied and observed at all, that meant that large-scale social scientific studies in the workplace were very, very suspicious and very difficult to have any real valid results. This was also the beginning of what folks call people-oriented management, where the real understanding of how to manage a workplace was kind of reduced to an equation that went something like this. If you give workers a sense that they're participating in the workplace, the result is you'll get increased morale from those workers. When you have increased morale or happy workers, you get increased productivity. But getting increased productivity is exactly what the managers wanted all around. So in a sense, it's more important to let the workers think that they're getting increased control or participation, when in fact what's really happening is that management is getting more control because they're manipulating the workers. It's just in a different way. The human relations movement really suggested that managers need to forge a relationship with employees that facilitated both downward communication, giving orders to an employee, and upward communication, hearing what the workers had to say. Unfortunately, it was not a true relationship, because I think for Roethlisberger and Mayo and a lot of people in the human relations movement, they really weren't ready to cede any authority to the workers. And so they would give them kind of the illusion of participation, make it seem like they were actually participating, when in fact the managers still pretty much held all the cards. You know, it might cost you a few $1,000s to set up a bowling league, but if that bought you industrial peace and workers working harder, it's a pretty good investment on the basis of management. They're not really doing it because they want people to feel better. They wanted to do it because it meant that people ultimately would work harder. So it was just another way to try and control the workers, to try and get them doing what you wanted the managers to do. It was just a little more sophisticated than the brute force of the classical management theories. It's not really until the mid-1950s that you began to see, I think, a more honest attempt in dealing with workers in a more kind of one-to-one basis, and getting to recognize that workers do have needs, that the way they feel about the job and the way they feel about themselves is extremely important, and that ultimately this resulted in a need to change the way management worked. The person I'm going to point to next is called Douglas McGregor. He wrote a great book in the mid-1950s called The Human Side of Enterprise. And really what he was looking at is the way in which it mattered greatly about your relationship with your workers and how you manage them. It's also the source of one of the more famous, I think, elements of management theory that you've probably already heard of. Douglas McGregor was the person who really coined the notion of Theory X and Theory Y. And what McGregor said was, if you look at the older classical management theories, and if you look at some of the more traditional industries, even at work today in the United States, and this was in the mid-1950s, you would find that the theory of how the workplace is supposed to work is dominated by some assumptions, which he kind of aggregated and called Theory X. And you see there on your slide, I hope, among the things that made up Theory X was the notion that managers believe that people really don't like to work, that they so don't like to work that they have to be closely supervised, because if you stop supervising them, they would stop working. and that people need to be coerced, that essentially management was a coercive kind of relationship with workers, that you had to pay attention all the time because these people would screw around if you didn't have management in place that would make sure and compel these people to do the job. The third little box there is probably the conceit that allowed managers to continue to do their job. Because Theory X, McGregor claimed, leads managers to believe that workers like to be told what to do. That left to their own devices, they'd be like sheep. They'd, you know, wandering around waiting for somebody to tell them what to do, waiting for someone to follow. The conceit in Theory X was that people actually prefer direction. They don't want to have to make these choices from themselves. It's really important for managers to manage this way because workers expect it. Workers are sheep. Workers need to be told what to do. And the thing that kind of draws it all together and makes this whole Theory X work was the notion that workers, above all else, desire security. Security in the job, security in their lives, and therefore, the way to ultimately get a worker to work was to threaten their security. To say, if you don't do work this way, you can't work here anymore. If you don't meet your quota goal of, you know, writing 5 mortgages a month, then we're not going to, you know, we're going to lay you off. We're going to fire you. And that threat of firing, that threat of non-security was often what workers or managers in Theory X used to get people to do their jobs. That was Theory X. McGregor said, you know, that's the way we used to think about workers, but there are lots of industries now where, frankly, that model, that Theory X really doesn't or shouldn't have to work. That we have a different way of thinking about how people kind of live their lives in organizations, in businesses. And that new wave of thinking, he described as Theory Y. And Theory Y had some very different notions about people and how they relate to work. The first notion was that work is natural, that people want to work. That they want to be able to feel productive. They want to be able to feel like they're doing something positive. That they take pride in their work because they're supporting their families, because they're doing a job that their, you know, forefathers did before them. Whatever it is, people need to work and they need to feel good about work. A second notion was that coercion, kind of the centerpiece of Theory X, is wrong. That ethically it's wrong to coerce people. You shouldn't be issuing party invitations like, come to the party or we'll kill the puppy, right? That's coercive. Similarly, elements of management that coerce people to do things are ultimately wrong, and managers need to think of other ways to motivate their employees. Among the things they can do is to provide workers with a job, with a career, where they can realize kind of the full flowering of what it is, they are about as human beings. Self-actualization is the term that Abraham Maslow used. You may be familiar with his hierarchy of needs. We'll talk about it more specifically in the persuasion lecture towards the end of the semester. But ultimately, self-actualization says that we all have this kind of certain potential as human beings, and in our lives we seek to reach that pinnacle where, you know, our physical needs are taken care of, our social needs, our relationship needs, and now we need to be able to go out and achieve as human beings. And McGregor totally bought into this and said, you know, if we can build jobs, if we can design organizations with the ultimate goal of allowing people to self-actualize, we're going to have a very powerful organization. The final element in Theory Y for McGregor was, again, kind of the thing that holds it all together, is the notion that people will actually seek responsibility. They will actually seek out additional work if you structure their job in such a way that they can self-actualize, if they can really find great contentment and a feeling of accomplishment in their work, that you'll be amazed at what they can do and that they will actually seek additional responsibilities. Employees will come to you and say, I was able to finish that project. Is there something else I can do? Now, I'm not sure, and even McGregor admitted that not all organizations, not all workplaces, not all businesses can be run with Theory Y. But what he did say is there's a lot more businesses out there that ought to be run by Theory Y. We ought to be shedding Theory X whenever we can, whenever it's appropriate, and moving people to Theory Y. Well, as you can imagine, Theory Y puts a completely different spin on how communication works in those kinds of situations. In a Theory Y organization, messages have to travel all over the place. They go up from subordinates to superiors, they go down from superiors to subordinates, and they go across the organization between people at similar organizational levels. Part of a Theory Y organization is that people work collaboratively, decision-making is more diffused, and the result is that you've got more people able to kind of be trusted with the ability to make that decision. Once you have decision-making that's not held centrally, once it is more decentralized, then you've got to have more communication running throughout an organization, because instead of one person making the decision at the top of the hierarchy, and therefore all kind of communication would flow ultimately from that one authority figure, you've now got communication and decision-making authority that's really spread throughout an organization. In Theory Y organizations, McGregor really believed you had to build an atmosphere of trust and confidence in your employees. Remember, they want to be there. They want to work. They want to be productive. They want to be able to produce really important things, and you have to trust them to do that. And that, again, is a very distant kind of a significant change from the classical management theories. The final thing that managers really have to be willing to do is to give up what's called managerial control. Instead of a supervisor standing over and supervising very tightly and very closely a small group of employees, there has to be a willingness on the part of management to kind of ease back a little bit and to not micromanage everything that your subordinates do. You have to trust that your subordinates are trained in their job, you've hired good people, you've set up the situation so that they can go out and achieve, and now the best thing a manager can do is to sit back and let that happen a little bit. That's tough. That's a very difficult thing for a lot of managers to be willing to go through. And as a result, it can really challenge the people involved in management to be willing to follow through. But it's really necessary in the eyes of folks like McGregor. Now, remember, McGregor's writing in the mid-1950s, but really it kind of ushered in a huge change in American business and about how we thought about systems of control and management theory. I have a couple more slides I need to talk about. I've got about 10 minutes or so to do that. I think we'll make it just fine. Systems theory. Interesting. Systems theory began to develop in the mid-1950s and 1960s and apply to business really in the 1960s. It really comes out of biology. The original writer on systems theory was a fellow by the name of Ludwig von Bertalanffy. And you don't really need to know that, I suppose, for the exam, but I just like to say Ludwig von Bertalanffy. The deal was he was a biologist, and he was trying to describe or build a metaphor for how it is that organisms, human organisms, animal organisms, how do they function? And really what happened is people began to take the writings of Bertalanffy and apply them kind of in metaphoric form to organizations and organizational theory. A couple of sociologists by the name of Katz and Kahn were really influential in making this leap. What they said was, we need to change the metaphor for understanding businesses and organizations from this machine metaphor that the classical management theorists had of organizations to an understanding that an organization is an organism. Think about that. It's like an organization is a cell. An organization is an animal. Cells need inputs, oxygen, food, and they have outputs, waste, maybe more productive things, right? But when you begin to think of an organization as an organism, you begin to see that the way in which you think about how an organization works begins to broaden a lot, because all of a sudden your suppliers are really part of the system that allows your organization to function. All of a sudden, it's not just enough to focus on the workers that you have, but maybe what you also need to focus on is the educational system in your community that provides you with skilled workers that allows your company to continue. You need to think about your customers in different ways, because they are the consumers of your output, which means that you have to pay more attention to what they want and how they want those products delivered and what their concerns are with quality and things like that. This is really a profound change in the way people begin to view an organization. As a result, there are really some key changes in how you manage. For instance, the most important thing when you're using systems theory to think about an organization is the way in which the different systems are integrated together and work together. And so in a business sense, what we're talking about is, how do the operations people relate to the research and development people? How do the marketing people relate to the people who have to do and provide customer service for a product? How do the salespeople relate to all of those folks? So it's important that these individual departments not be working in isolation, because the important thing for an organization to work successfully is that all of those systems work together. Just as in a cell, you know, you get the system that provides the oxygen, the respiratory system, the muscular system, the chemical system that kind of keeps that organism alive. All of those things have to work together. In systems theory, and it's not surprising that communication studies folks who wanted to study organizations would pick up on systems theory particularly, is because one of the key elements then in understanding whether or not a system, an organization, a business is functioning well productively is how good their communication is between the different systems. So all of a sudden, communication kind of becomes a privileged part of any analysis of an organization. So it's not surprising that communication theorists would gravitate toward an approach that in some ways privileges what they do. Okay, I'm not saying this is the only approach. It's still very influential, but not necessarily the only way to think about how to manage an organization. But the communication networks themselves, how finance talks to marketing, how HR communicates with all the employees in the organization. Communication networks become a privileged way of getting to understand how an organization works. And even informal communication begins to be recognized as a system. By the mid-1950s, we've pretty much figured out that informal communication, the kind of communication that's really not bound by organizational charts, is an important thing for organizations to run well. And so in systems theory, informal communication is really acknowledged, because this is just one big system with competing subsystems. The way those subsystems keep in touch with one another is through communication. And so you can see that this orientation towards management would privilege communication. It would make sure that people are talking and adjusting their work product and their output. It would give businesses a very different approach to thinking about the job that they do, because it's not just about what's inside the building. It's not about what's just on the organizational chart, but it's everything that supplies inputs to an organization, whether it's raw materials or personnel or whatever else, and it's everything that results in outputs. So whether we're talking about the waste that's produced in the plant, the toxic waste, or we're talking about the product that you're selling, both of those are outputs. One's a more positive output than the other, but it means that you have to deal with them and understand how they affect the environment around you. If you produce too much product, then maybe you hurt yourself in terms of price. You have to look at the entire organization as a part of this much larger context. And for many organizational theorists, this is a superior way, because it really approximates what's the environment out there. Something like systems theory, for those of you who may be having jobs right now, you may be familiar with a mechanism called 360-degree evaluation. So if I'm evaluating a manager and I'm doing 360-degree evaluations, what we're really talking about here is that in gathering data to decide how good a job this manager is doing, I would talk to that manager's subordinates, that is, the people that person manages. I would talk to their superiors, the people above them and the people below them, and I would talk to other managers in the same position as that person, so their colleagues, the people at the same organizational chart. So it really becomes top, bottom, around 360 degrees. This can be a very effective way of really getting a better idea of how managers function. If you're a sales manager and the only thing that they look at in order to analyze how good a job you're doing is your output numbers, if they only look at whether or not you meet your goals, that is an important but not necessarily critically important or the only kind of variable that's important. A good 360-degree evaluations lets folks understand exactly how people are doing in their jobs. So, for instance, some years ago, my wife was operating as a salesperson. And before 360-degree evaluation, she was solely judged on her sales numbers. After 360-degree evaluation, she was analyzed not only from her sales output, but what kind of help she gave to other salespeople. Her customers were interviewed as a part of her evaluation process, and they found that, for instance, her customers were far more loyal and far more positive about her coming into their workplace than when other salespeople, either from their company or someplace else, showed up. It was a fuller picture of getting to understand exactly how this is working. So it has some very practical implications. I want to end with a theorist that's a more contemporary theorist. We're talking about, 1960s, 1970s. William Ouchi, O-U-C-H-I, wrote a little book called Theory Z. And really, this has been used, there have been different names applied to this. First, Theory Z is obviously a kind of take or an extension of what McGregor did with Theory X and Theory Y, but it's also been called contingency management or transformative management. Really, Ouchi was the one who really got people focusing on corporate culture. That's a term that Rosabeth Moss Kanter certainly made her career on. But ultimately, if you look at Ouchi's work here, you see him investigating organizations the way an anthropologist might investigate a foreign country, an island nation, the way Margaret Mead went to the South Pacific and investigated all of the practices that this particular, not judging them as superior or inferior, but going in and saying, oh, this is the way they do things here. And for Ouchi, the important things were for managers to focus on a corporate culture that built significant interpersonal relationships between subordinates and superiors, again, very, very different from Weber, that the focus for the organizations were on long-term employment. So some of the places that Ouchi looked at were places like IBM, Hewlett-Packard, places that really had long-term commitments to their employees. Theory Z is also very much about collaboration and making sure that decision-making was pushed as far down into an organization as possible, because he knew that if you began to involve people in significant decisions, they would take more ownership of the decisions that were made. They would make a more significant effort to make sure that those changes, if they were changes, were implemented well within the area of their organization. Finally, it sensed in Theory Z that there had to be a respect for an employee and that the employer really had a significant concern for their well-being. This is really the birthplace of things like employee assistance programs. Programs that were designed for wellness all of a sudden became very important. And a lot of that can be traced back to Theory Z. The final thing I would suggest, that if we were all smart enough when Theory Z came out, when this book was published, to have gone to the back of the book and put $1,000 into the stock market, in the stock of the publicly traded companies that Weechi described in his book, we would all be mega multimillionaires at this point, because the corporate partners that he looked at and that he spent time with are almost all ones that have been hugely successful through the late 1970s and on into the 21st century. Again, you know, 2020 hindsight in this case. As a closing thought, what I'd simply like to say is that one of the significant parts of the fact that you're coming to Comm Studies to take this course is that I want to build a bridge between our disciplines and get you to understand that there are ways of using communication studies as a lens to think about and to see how business practices work or don't work. One of the important parts of that is seeing how management theory, which can be studied in the business school and kind of be, you know, in isolation, can be viewed through the lens of communication. One of the important things I would ask about any management theory is ultimately, how does it view communication? How does communication, you know, come together in their view, or this new kind of idea of running an organization? Because I think, as I've been able to demonstrate here, there are significant differences in the way organizations work and ultimately in the way communication works in those organizations, and that can be an important indicator, an important outward tool that can be used by managers, that can be used by consultants to make sure that organizations get better. Okay, that's all for today. Thanks very much.